So it's a pleasure to welcome myself to Many Rivers Books and Tea, not for the first time. And someone's phone is ringing, Jim. That's okay. So this is a talk about mysticism, and it's a subject that I've been thinking a lot about lately, because our good friend Ken McLeod, who's a Tibetan teacher, has been talking about the subject of mysticism and what sets the mystical enterprise apart from other forms and understandings of spiritual practice, etc. So I further was stimulated to do this talk because I just got a review copy of this book from some friends of mine. It's called Every Day a Holy Day: Exercises, Experiments, and Practices for Mindful Living by Barbara Haynes. And I will talk about why this has been an inspiration for me and for this subject matter as well as we get along. But first I'll just open it up. What do people think of, what's mysticism? What the heck is mysticism? Any ideas? You don't have to have a I have some definitions here which I'll go over, but I'm just wondering where people locate themselves on this map.
The word suggests something to me of the word mystery,
mm-hmm.
which implies that whatever it's about, it hasn't all been reduced to concrete, black and white.
Okay. That sounds helpful and relevant. Thank you. Any other ideas?
I was thinking, for me, it's like intuition.
Okay.
In touch with, you could call it mystery, too.
Okay. All right. Well, if there aren't other suggestions, I will give you some material from what has been somebody in the store here called Lord Google. Oh, you got something? What?
That was takes me a little while.
Got it.
Yeah. Where I'm not knowing. Takes on a bigger role than it has to do with the relationship between the knowing and the not knowing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the is that enough?
That's more than enough. Oh. I think that suggests linkages with some of these other points that people have made. So like an hour before I came over here tonight, I went to Lord Google and typed in mysticism and selected on the drop-down bar definition, mysticism mm-hmm. definition. And so without going to dictionary.com, which is my usual habit, this was the first definition that Lord Google offered. Mysticism, I think, actually there's two definitions, and it's actually quite instructive, I think. The similarities and differences. So definition one, belief that union with or absorption into the deity or the absolute, or the spiritual apprehension of knowledge inaccessible to the intellect, may be attained through contemplation and self-surrender. Okay? So belief that union with or absorption into the deity or the absolute, or the spiritual apprehension of knowledge inaccessible to the intellect, may be attained through contemplation and self-surrender. So number two is belief characterized by self-delusion or dreamy confusion of thought, especially when based on the assumption of occult qualities or mysterious agencies. I'll read that one again. It's worth the. There, obviously, there are similarities and differences, Not so many similarities at first, but I'll make the point that there is a similarity between them. Belief characterized by self-delusion or dreamy confusion of thought, especially when based on the assumption of occult qualities or mysterious agencies. So, that's cool. We are even getting some chuckles.
It all depends on where you're standing.
Exactly. So, but I want to point out that both of these definitions begin with the word belief. That is the linkage between the two, the similarity between the two. One is a belief about union with or absorption into something greater, and the other is a belief characterized by self-delusion or confusion. So I think it's fair to say that if you ask most Americans, they'd be more likely to go with numero duo than number one. I don't mean to say that all Americans would agree with that, but I do think that that's a pretty common understanding of the word mystical. That is, I think mysticism is usually seen as other. It's not something that I would do, not something that I have access to. Even if you were to go with the description in number one of union or absorption into the deity or the absolute, I think most Americans would suggest that that's not possible or practical for them. Does anyone have any different view on that? I'm curious to know.
I just had an experience the other day. I thought I need to meditate more, so mm-hmm. I was meditating in the morning, and then I was walking through my house, and then this phone number came into my head, 4862-7, and I just thought, I don't know who that is, but I'll call it. And it was my friend who I haven't talked to in like a year, and we had all these synchronicities, and it was great. But I think that was a mystical experience, that there's kind of like an ownership where you could call meditation absorption. It was just semantics. It was just quieting down and,
mm-hmm.
being in touch with whatever you want to call it.
Got it.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that. And I'm wondering if most people that you told that to, would they think, oh, I agree with your characterization of what happened, or would they actually, whether they told you or not, would they actually think, oh, she just thought of that because she knows the number and it just happened to pop into her head and she called it and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, no, I used to know the number.
Right.
I used to call her, but we
right.
haven't been in touch for like
right.
a
right. So, I understand that.
She was right on board because we've gone to meditations together, retreats, and we met in Kriya Yoga initiation. So it was really, she was totally on board with that.
Got
it. She did mention to one other person.
Right.
And he, it was very jarring and trying to fit it into his mm-hmm. belief system.
Okay. Well, let me then go on to the other definition where Lord Google offered me a list of things to click on about definitions of mysticism, and what I happened to click on was from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and it's the first paragraph of a fairly long definition, but I actually liked it. So it says, the term mysticism comes from the Greek, meaning to conceal. In the Hellenistic world, mystical referred to secret religious rituals. So that would fit in with where we started with Carl's observation about mystery, I think. In early Christianity, the term came to refer to, quote, hidden, unquote, allegorical interpretations of scriptures, and to hidden presences, such as that of Jesus at the Eucharist. Only later did the term begin to denote mystical theology, which included direct experience of the divine. Typically, mystics, theistic or not, in other words, the ones who are talking about union with the divine or union with the absolute, see their mystical experience as part of a larger undertaking aimed at human transformation. See, for example, Teresa of Avila. They give a reference to this famous mystic's work, chapter 19 of her book Life. So let me start that sentence again because I want to go on. Typically, mystics, theistic or not, see their mystical experience as part of a larger undertaking aimed at human transformation and not as the terminus of their efforts. In other words, mysticism is not an end, but it is a means or a journey, depending on how you want to interpret that sentence. Thus, in general, mysticism would best be thought of as a constellation of distinctive practices, discourses, texts, institutions, traditions, and experiences aimed at human transformation, variously defined in different traditions. So I'm curious, about responses to that. I'm going to get myself some more tea here. Because I think that's an interesting frame that's different than the material earlier.
Personal transformation or transformation?
Human transformation.
In
human transformation.
Like teaching people about it or just personal?
I don't think there's a distinction being made in that, what it sounds like you're wanting to make that distinction, though, and why?
Oh, I was confused. Is it just your personal mystical experience? Is it collective, or is it?
Well, I'll read it again, and you decide if. I mean, my reading of it is that it would include both, but the last two sentences. Typically, mystics see their mystical experience as part of a larger undertaking aimed at human transformation. So you could say that refers to something like the famous Arthur C. Clarke science fiction novel, Childhood's End. I don't know how many of you may be familiar with that.
I've already forgotten it. I read it probably 40 years ago, 50
yeah.
years ago.
It made a huge impression on me. In that book, there's a kind of I won't spoil it by describing the particulars, but there's an evolution of the human species collective, with a few holdouts, into a higher level of consciousness, such that those human bodies are no longer present. And there are plenty of other science fiction works I could point to that have a similar kind of direction.
Well, now you're touching on my question, which is transformation from what into what?
Mm-hmm. Got it. And what would you say about that?
I would say I'd like to know what they're talking about. I mean, because that word is bandied about with great cavalierness. In modern days, as is the word sacred and a few other pet peeves of mine.
Got it.
So, I'm just.
So what do you take transformation to mean? If you read it in a sense like that, let's say letting go of the pet peeve of not of lack of clarity. What would you wish it to mean?
Well, I can tell you what I wish instead of transformation, I would tend to use another word, which I won't be the first to use it, more like realization.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like living into the potential of who we can be. And if that requires transformation, well, okay. But I think people see it, transformation, in sort of a nuts and bolts, turning a wrench kind of thing. Well, we're going to do this and then be transformed into something wonderful.
I get that. Maybe that's your engineering background.
Maybe it is, but I get the feel that there's a mechanistic component in modern society, uh-huh, which treats even spiritual matters as, you know, you think you use the right tool, you're going to inevitably get the result that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So.
Got it. Okay.
I would agree that that's a common understanding or a familiar attitude that transformation has to mean some great big thing that's mm-hmm. everlasting, you know, and I'm thinking of it more transformation or realization as being having a access to a perspective of oneself that's different from the usual, more expansive.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily lasting at all. I've had some chenshos like that in meditation retreats and things.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't, you know, mean that I was going to live differently very much after that, except that I value the experience, but it's not, you know, I'm not all fixed,
mm-hmm.
which is the way I think. Another thing that people think of when they think of transformation is kind of like your
I think that's a
spiritual...
Fair, I think that's a good point.
What's that spiritual bypass?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Idea.
Thank you. That's the. I think there's a lot of truth in what you say, but what, as you were saying it, what you made me think of was this book that I said had been one of the inspirations for this talk, and I want to read just a short passage, just a 2-page passage. Here, it's actually the author's preface. She says, I first came across the idea of using exercises or experiments to open new perspectives on myself, the environment, and my relationships with others when I encountered E.J. Gold's book, Practical Work on Self, in 1984. This book, which is also over there, I believe. Mr. Gold offers exercises in his book that allowed me to gain a new understanding of myself. I worked with each of the 24 exercises on Practical Work on Self and found the results revealing. I had a most profound experience while doing the popcorn exercise. That's one of the exercises in this book over there. She says, I was driving my car, a stick shift, and attempting to watch the movements of my body doing its job while keeping an eye on traffic. Suddenly, quote, things, unquote, changed. Though traffic continued, it felt as if everything had gone into slow motion. I could see around the car in a way that would not normally have been possible, more like a sensing than a seeing. I drove another 5 or 10 minutes in that state before I arrived home. When I left the car, I had a definite feeling of having been cared for ever so gently by the car. And I gave it a pat on the trunk and thanks. I walked through the house and finally sat down on the sofa, where I enjoyed another half hour of heightened perceptions. One Wednesday afternoon about a year ago, as I was preparing dinner, I had the thought, how easy it would be to keep the kitchen clean and exercise my attention if I remembered all the things and areas I had touched during meal preparation and made sure to clean them during cleanup. My Wednesday afternoon meal prep inspiration got me to thinking about the various little exercises, experiments, and practices I have done over the years, and the ones I currently do to strengthen my attention and presence. I decided to gather them together and share them. At one time or another, I've done all the exercises in this book. Some have become a part of my life, while others I pick up and put down as the need arises. They have all come from personal experience, personally experienced. The exercises are not in a particular order. I encourage you to use them in whatever way works for you, opening the book and letting synchronicity take a hand and choosing which one you will do that day is a great way to approach the exercises. Keeping a journal can help you work with the exercises as you have the experiences you have as you do the different exercises. So that's what this book is about. And you'll see, as I sort of ripple through it, that it's a bunch of very short little, just maybe 2, 3, 4 sentences on a page with a name. She's got artwork behind each one. And they offer exercises. So one of the reasons, and your comment stimulated my recollection of the inspiration that I found in this book, was that your comment about transformation as being this overwhelming thing that, you know, what's that phrase that's so common on the internet now? This changes everything. Who hasn't seen that? This changes everything. You know, it's gotten to be pretty repellent to me when I see that, because how many times can this change everything? Unless you're coming from a place a little different than what we normally think of, and in terms of our normal human foibles, predilections, capacities. You know, most people, and the perspective taken by, you know, Mr. Gold in this book, for example, Practical Work on Self, is that most of us have habits that we mechanically reproduce, whether we notice that we're doing that or not. So what would transformation mean with respect to those habits? Well, presumably it would mean that we're no longer mechanically reproducing them. Maybe we would take the same actions but do so deliberately, as opposed to not having any conscious choice about it.
One possibility. Another
is that we might have a different perspective as we deliberately do the same thing as our habit inclination would have us do. Mm-hmm. So in fact, that's what some of the exercises in this book suggest. So I'm just gonna read one here. This is a particularly appropriate one for where we are right now. This is called Street Sounds. If you live in a busy city, this will be an exercise that is easily accessed. When you find yourself in the midst of a very busy and loud city environment, listen to the sounds as if they are musical instruments or conversations of unknown beings. Let go of significance related to the sounds. Let yourself listen for the play between the sounds. So what if these sounds that we just had access to a moment ago, and will again in a moment, I feel sure, are conversations of unknown beings? What does it do to ask ourselves that question and then let the mind open in that way to this unexpected and unusual way of relating to those sounds? I'm not asking for an answer. I'm simply offering this as something we can do here just for a moment, ourselves. We can add the sound of the air conditioning. So there are science fiction movies where people are thrust into unusual environments that have both familiar and unfamiliar qualities. I think it's the movie Inception that I'm thinking of, where at the beginning of the movie there are cityscapes, and then the cityscapes begin sliding apart and moving around in ways that are profoundly disconcerting, and but also feel meaningful. So that's another way that that came to my mind just now as I was listening to the sounds available to us. Yeah.
The word meaningful rings a familiar bell in my mind, because that's one of the things that I believe I try to look for a meaning, like listening to the sounds as if the sounds were conversations between unknown beings, then they would perhaps take on a meaning that's different than if they're random, disconnected.
Yeah,
ones.
Absolutely.
It connects everything.
Right. That's right. So what if everything? So in a way, this is an invitation, this particular exercise is an invitation to meditate on connection, meaningful connection of things that we assume in our ordinary consciousness as not being connected. It's not that we have to come to a conclusion, but we can shift our consciousness into a different space. So one of the things I wanted to offer in this discussion is that this is not something remote that only historical saints like Teresa of Avila or she's now dead, but Mother Teresa or other people that are often regarded as saints, contemporary people living in distant lands or in circumstances that are very different than our understanding of our own experience or experiences. We don't have to assume that mysticism is only there, away from us, outside of us. So there are lots of ways, just this one book, and I actually have other books here too, but just this one book has, I don't know, at least, over a hundred exercises that you can do in the midst of your daily life to shift your experience away from the habit of thinking of things in the ordinary way, the consensus reality story that we subscribe to, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Now, some of us have stuff, you know, the impression that you were describing of intuitions, and that there are things around the edges of the consensus reality story that we can point to, and I would agree with you. I do agree with you. And I'm suggesting that's just the start of something that could be more profound than the usual way we think of transformation. You know, Carl's point about mechanistic transformation, I think, is well taken. That in the consensus reality story, transformation is assumed to be this, I don't know, it's billiard balls in the universe or something like that, you know? But if we think of ambient sounds as something very different than what we usually think of them as. It's not that it has to be true or false. It's the utility of using the circumstances of our lives to try on different perspectives, try on different possibilities, and see what that might do. One of my this is a new book. In fact, we don't even have it in the store yet, but I'm going to order some copies for the store. But one of the books we've had for a while, or a couple of the books we've had for a while, is by a friend of mine named Claude Needham. He has a couple of books. One is called The Any Game Cookbook, Recipes for Spiritual Gaming, and the other is The Just Because Club, Your Personal Metaphysical Fitness Trainer. But I like the Any Game Cookbook because when we go into playing a game with people, whether that's an explicit game or whether it's just a reproduction of the way we engage with certain people at certain times, which you could call a game, there's things you can do that might change your experience of that. So one of the things he starts off with in this Any Game cookbook is I Wish, and the recipe that he uses, he calls it a recipe, is before playing any game, vocalize or sub-vocalize the following wish. I wish this to be used for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Now, we've all heard that one from Buddhist trails, but he goes on to say, in the appendices of this book, you'll find a few notes on the subject of sub-vocalizations. Let me just summarize them here. Don't just think the words. Use your voice. It doesn't matter how loud or how soft. Just make sure you are using your voice. When you use your voice, you will bring the wish from the domain of idle thought into the realm of active intention. I'll repeat that last one. When you use your voice, you will bring the wish from the domain of idle thought into the realm of active intention. Now, I don't expect you to take this for just because he says it or because I'm repeating it to you. But it's another possibility worth exploring, that if I vocalize as opposed to simply repeat in my head, I wish this game, or I wish this exercise, or I wish this blah, 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 to be used for the benefit of all beings everywhere. He says that makes a difference.
I think I agree with him immediately, because I think of the voice and the throat chakra, in particular, being associated with will, and he used the word.
Yes, he did. Exactly. So I think that's right. It also takes the thought out of the head, or removes it only from that realm, the realm of active intention, as he puts it, is different than the realm of, as he calls it, idle thought.
But you've got the body involved.
You've got the body involved. Exactly right. And one of the other things that I like in this book is he's talking, of course, about in many of these exercises, he's talking about actually playing a game. It could be Monopoly, it could be Dungeons and Dragons, it could be whatever the heck it is, right? He says his recipe for this one particular thing is, each turn of the game, remind yourself, I'm playing a game. Sub-vocalize the phrase, each turn. That means, don't just think the words, use your voice. Doesn't matter how loud or how soft, just make sure you're using your voice. As you say, I'm playing a game, you may or may not have thoughts, feelings, or what have you, ripple about in response to the sub-vocalization. Don't be attracted nor repelled. by these random bits. So, we could all say it actually right now. I am playing a game. This game is called a talk. And I'm one of the players, and you guys are other players. So, I am playing a game. Okay? So, don't be attracted or repelled by whatever arises in you, but do notice them. He goes on to say, this is not a philosophy. You don't win a prize for the quantity or even the quality of ideas stimulated by this mentation. At the same time, you don't have to be fearsome or fearful of ideas. There is no prize and there is no penalty. This is not psychology. You don't win a prize for the degree of spin or depth of tweak brought about by this sub-vocalization. At the same time, you need not dread the prospect that some things may come up in response to the sub-vocalization. There is no prize and there is no penalty. This is not a soap opera. You don't need to look for or run away from melodrama. It is neither wanted nor rejected. During the game, as your turn comes around, simply state, I'm playing a game. Don't just repeat the phrase like a somnambulistic robot. Put some energy into it. Like dropping a pebble into a pond, each repetition of the phrase will bring ripples. That's the nature of things. These ripples are neither good nor bad. They just are. One of the things that I think people respond to about the idea of mysticism and the various ideas of mysticism are here before, some of them quite opposite, apparently. Especially the two basic beliefs about it, is that mysticism is good. In fact, mysticism is maybe the highest good. Some people have that idea. Because, I mean, how could absorption or union with, you know, something greater than yourself be bad? Sounds like the best good around, right? And yet if the game is union, what if you take the attitude that he's promoting here, that it's neither good nor bad? The consequences of changing your perspective so that you are open to perceptions that are not normally present for you doesn't have to be either good or bad. In fact, if it's good or bad, that's back into the regular game where you're not vocalizing or sub-vocalizing that I'm playing the game. You're just back in the common human space. That's what I propose for your consideration tonight. And that it's that shift of attention that offers us something, a possibility of something different. And that shift of those shifts of perspective, because every time you engage in one of these exercises or experiments, and that's another way to look at it, what happens if you keep doing an experiment over and over and all these different things happen? Neither good nor bad. And that's not the point, to find out whether they're good or bad, the consequences. But if we're constantly sub-vocalizing, as in this particular exercise, or in the one from here, in fact I'll read another one from Barbara Haynes' book, the street sounds one I was referring to a moment ago, but let's find another one here. Ah, here we go. When walking, and you could do this just by moving your arm The name of it is Walking Through Air. When walking, feel the air move across your body, even indoors. Don't change the way you move, but get the idea that you are moving through a substance that is flowing around you. I'll just do that for a minute here. You are welcome to join me. Just get the feeling I'm just walking around, that there's a substance that is flowing around me, and I am not usually aware of it. So that's interesting. Neither good nor bad. And yet if I take it seriously, it's not quite the same as I would usually be thinking. Yeah.
It illustrates to me that there is always more going on than I'm noticing.
Ah. I think that's an important part of... So if there's something to the idea, but we would always want to experience the idea somehow. But if there's something to the idea of union with or absorption of something in something larger, then that would be a useful reminder. And not one that we want to stop with. We then want to choose another opportunity to keep making the familiar unfamiliar.
Yeah, it brings up choice, for one thing. If there is something going on, like the flow of air over our bodies as we move,
mm-hmm.
we can choose to be aware of it, but we may choose not to pay much attention to it at all. It brings up the whole thing about choice. We make unconscious choices all the time to disregard things that are not important to us.
Right. And I think most so-called famous mystics would probably say that the choices we make in that way, not to pay attention to certain things, are based on a kind of consensus reality version of things that reinforces itself. You're looking like you're in pain.
I was just thinking that what you're pointing to is just has to do with inhabiting the moment creatively and being the artist of your own, being the artist of your own moment.
Okay.
And considering all of the ingredients that are involved in the moment, which ultimately is everything, is the whole cosmos is involved in just in the creation of the moment. So I think it has to do with exploring the challenge of creativity, of inhabiting the moment creatively.
Uh-huh.
Would you
agree?
Yeah,
but I would add that it's necessary to keep the problem with the word creativity, and it's not a terrible problem, but it is a problem. Is that one of its aspects is the idea of creativity as opposed to the experience of creativity. So if, and this is true for any of the things that we've just been talking about, the moment we notice there's something different, there's an invitation of our habit energy to rest in that place. And that could be creativity. Oh, now I'm being creative, or now I'm exploring creativity, or now I'm doing this, or now I'm exploring new realms of sound, or now I'm exploring whatever it happens to
but
be.
That's not creative.
And then, what's that?
That's not creative.
Well, that's the point, is that resting in an idea is is putting down these tools, and that that is the tendency that the you know, the word transformation that Carl doesn't like is meant to point to, that transformation would not simply be twisting a nut, you know, and then saying you're done. And that's it's an important truth in my view. By the way, I would contrast conviction with belief. And conviction to me is something for which you have evidence in your own experience. Mm. Belief is something that you're just accepting on faith, and not faith in a positive way.
I have a question.
Yeah.
At some point along the way, I was thinking of when I was teaching my son to talk. Mm-hmm. He'd walk along the street, and I'd say, "This is a sidewalk." And then I thought, well, we can forget about that now. You know, it's a sidewalk.
Right.
It's not like, I just felt like it was so reductionist to naming things. And
right.
Then
Absolutely, and the Taoists are very good about pointing out the danger in that. You know, the Taoist masters and some of their writings and texts are very good at pointing to the danger of naming. So the danger of naming the Tao. Oops. As soon as you've done that, you've lost it. Whereas, you know, when I was a kid, sidewalks. I was constantly fascinated by sidewalks. You know, yeah, exactly. There's cracks in it. There's little lines. There's the game of, you know.
Don't step on the crack, you'll break your mother's back.
That's right. Yeah, and then you're avoiding the cracks. And sometimes you're jumping on the cracks. You know, and all that stuff. But it's like this much more alive thing than ho hum, just a sidewalk.
And then what it's made of, where it came from, all the elements, people that made it, where did it, you know.
Yeah, here's a chip, here's where a chip broke off, and look, there's a rock, there's some rock sticking out of it there, you know, which you don't necessarily see if it's more or less intact shortly after being formed.
And the cars or whatever, the beings that were making the sound when we were listening, mm-hmm. they're made up of, you know, elements. Crystals with computers, there's crystals in there, there's all, they are pretty much beings, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a transformation of thought for me. It's like, cars, okay. But then, that exercise was really transformative.
Good.
For a second.
Good. So then, I don't want to go too long tonight. I have a sort of, I think I've gotten across the idea that I wanted to get across here, the basic idea. Well, several. One, of course, is that mysticism, when we reduce it to belief, then we're stuck in the world of ideas, and we don't have access to anything that mysticism has to offer. And then, of course, this other definition sort of describes a process by which the idea of mysticism has changed over time. And there's nothing wrong with that, because things change over time. And yet, to get access to mysticism is not beyond us. That's the main thing. We don't need to do extreme things to have access to mystical understanding. We don't have to do, I don't know, 30 years of meditation, even though 30 years of meditation may well help us, among other things, not cling to the realizations that arise as the result of our experiments and the conclusions that arise as the result of our experiments. But let me just offer you a deeper
Can you just say that again? The last thing you said.
Which thing?
The things that arise if you have been meditating.
So meditation offers many can offer many benefits. Although I've known people who meditated for 20 or 30 years and were just felt just as lost as ever, too. But mysticism, excuse me, meditation can help us, I think, recognize that these experiments offer a process, an experiential process that we can tune into more and more frequently to keep us from falling back into our ideas about consensus reality. And then the more we engage in those practices, the more likely we are to find our understanding of the incredible richness of our experience, potentially and really, continues to expand. So that's another way to say it again. But this is from this book that Barbara Haynes mentioned, this book, Practical Work on Self by E.J. Gold. And it's the beginning of a chapter called Centrum of Gravity Question. Centrum of Gravity Question. He says, a centrum of gravity question is an essential question which we use to create slight discomfort, to keep ourselves off balance in relation to the machine's ordinary mechanical state of self-oblivion. By the machine, he means our usual mechanical habits that reproduce themselves, that recreate the what I was calling the consensus reality story earlier. Okay. So he says, we can make any question our temporary centrum of gravity. So this is the middle of a book, so I don't want to recapitulate the whole book, but a centrum of gravity, you can understand, would be a place where our energy rests. Energy of attention. We can make any question our temporary centrum of gravity until the machine awakens just by sheer agitation. But to make a question a working centrum of gravity, it must be an essential question, one that really is important to us, so our thirst cannot be easily quenched. This can work for us in the awakening of the machine only if we do not fall asleep in the mechanical satisfaction of easy answers. It's a nice way to say what I just said a moment ago. The mechanical satisfaction of easy answers. Especially answers from those whom we automatically admire because we believe they know more than we do. Like those famous mystics. Right? Probably because they intentionally gave us that impression by the use of clothing, atmospheric setting, and worshipful underlings. To really make a question mean more than just monkey curiosity, we must not seek a quick end to our restless inquiry. And I'll just make the observation that our restless inquiry is the state of how our minds operate most of the time, or tend to operate. If we can allow the machine to remain in the severe discomfort of the interior perturbations resulting from the unsettling disturbances which automatically arise from deep, serious questioning, even perhaps losing a night or two of sound sleep, we can use a question to keep the machine slightly off balance in relation to our ordinary complacent state, which sometimes results in a partial awakening of the machine. If we can use this process of deep questioning to penetrate the surface of the machine's mental apparatus, we can reach the deeper, more primitive levels of the machine, as indicated by the disturbances produced by the questioning. So here's this. So this is the image that he's creating: is that our machine is normally, if we don't question what's going on, as in the sort of quest, you know, smaller exercises that we've just been looking at, then we're not going to see anything different than what the story that we've been adhering to for all these years will tell us. But deep questioning, he's suggesting, creates perturbations. You know, something is moving in a way that we're not quite sure how or why internally. Serious questioning of a particular type, along with exact efforts to awaken the machine, will result in interior perturbations which show us that the machine is definitely protecting something which it does not want us to see. This penetration into the deepest levels of the machine, into the very flesh and blood of the machine, so to speak, can eventually produce the result such that the machine aligns itself to our higher aspirations. Okay. So that might be where the union, if something higher comes in, possibly, if that's what our higher aspiration is.
How could they possibly be served, those aspirations? How could they be served by a machine?
That's a great question, and that's a great question because the metaphor of the machine is usually used, in my understanding, and certainly by Mr. Gold, to describe the results of a process. You know, babies are not born as machines in the way that he's talking about, but their informal and formal education, particularly the informal education, the demonstrations that they see enacted around them, produce this unconscious way of relating to the universe.
Okay. Habitual,
right,
behavior.
Right. So the machine, if it is reconfigured, can actually create the habit of paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Which is different than the habit of directing your attention away from what's actually going on. So these little exercises are ways to disturb the habit so that we get these momentary glimpses of creativity or of connection or whatever it happens to be, or of intuition. And yet, we want to be able to be to have the machine, presumably, be fully in line with our highest aspirations. And so, we need to create conditions such that the mechanical processes that are happening in the machine actually come to serve the intention to align our bodies, minds, and hearts with those higher aspirations, as opposed to all these impulses that are constantly, you know, going in, you know, clashing with those aspirations as well as with each other.
I'm constructing my own metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I'm not sure if it's the same place that Gold is going with this,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of like the place I want him to be going with it.
Uh-huh.
And it is that we're actually waking up the operator of the machine. So the machine isn't only working on the basis of habit, it's under some conscious direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the machine has wonderful service it's offering as we go through our days and check both ways before going across the street automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Right.
So the machine can do wonderful service for an aware operator.
Mm-hmm.
But so you're saying by engaging some of these practices, for me you're saying you're waking up the operator to realize, there's a mechanistic aspect of my life,
mm-hmm.
which may serve, but I want there to be more than that.
Well, I actually, you know, in many ways that metaphor would be congruent with my own teacher's description. It's not the only description that's useful or relevant, but that is a useful one. There's a a lot of teachings, a lot of mystical teachings would suggest that that there's a way to enliven an operator, if you will, that has become encased in a mechanical machine, and that doesn't understand that there's other possibilities. So these little exercises that we were doing are reminders that there are other possibilities, number one. And then he's saying further that one of the ways to continue that process is to create this centrum of gravity question, which creates perturbations as by asking an essential question and not accepting simplistic answers to it.
It's like what koans do, right?
Yeah, and in a way, I think there's some accordance. Although,
just thinking
there's a little difference.
Paradox is a way to befuddle the.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be paradox. It could be it could be here's an example. He has a whole pages long list of possible centrum of gravity questions. Here's just one that I happened to. What exactly is the meaning of redemption? What is it that can, quote, suffer redemption, unquote? So if redemption is something that resonates for you, then what does it mean to ask that question and not accept straightforward, simple answers or even complex answers, but continually be asking that question such that we're creating a habit of not resting in answers.
And continually going deeper with the same question, I think.
And letting it can be like a mantra as well, a mantra that creates the repetition after a while without us having to deliberately think about it again, but it's creating the perturbations that are keeping us not resting in any kind of certainty. So it's
identifying in the question than identifying in the question, not identifying in.
I don't know about if identifying is the word I'd use, but certainly resting in the question, or resting in the question and its consequences, which might be neither good nor bad, and both good and bad, etc.
That's more like a witness than.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's actually helps create a witness function that does not identify. That's why I don't like the word identify, because identify generally means, oh, I am that question, or I am that answer, as opposed to something that that doesn't close off further witnessing, further examination, further inquiry. So that's some of the stuff that came up for me with regard to. These things. We have some books over there. I will be, as I said, be ordering some copies of this book, which I think is a very sweet way to start this every day, a holy day. If you want to look at it here, I'm happy to let you do that and take. I'm happy to take orders to add to the number of copies that I'm going to order. But then there are these other books, the gaming ones, which are fun, because usually usually we think of gaming as a time when we're actually relinquishing any inquiry. We're kind of just, oh, I'm going to have fun, right? I'm going to go play this game. But this the Any Game Cookbook is like an example of how to make those things part of this inquiry, self-questioning inquiry process. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Yay.
Yay.